So our newest topic, and this is, I believe, Making of Modern Judaism, Class 10, is Italian Jewry with a focus on the Rama of Menachem Azaria of Fano. Also, like I said, each week they get more and more fascinating. But in order to understand the significance of the Rama of Fano, and also maybe to understand a little bit more about his biography, we need to do a little bit of a background of Italian Jewry, which, believe it or not, even though I think most of us have probably never met someone who is an Italian Jew, nevertheless, it seems that the community in Italy is one of the oldest and richest in history. But also, I think one thing we'll discover is one of the most malleable and eclectic in those terms as well. Also, we'll discuss a little bit of the possible relationships that the Italian community has with the Ashkenazi community as well, and certainly the Sephardic community also. So we'll start with the beginnings of the Italian Jewish community, which is the Book of Maccabees records that both Judah Maccabee and Simon Maccabee sent ambassadors to Rome. Why were they sending ambassadors to Rome? So we all know that the Maccabees, in the holiday that's coming up, fought against not the Greeks, but the Seleucid dynasty in Assyria, I believe it was. And they went to Rome once they were establishing themselves as their own commonwealth. They went to the rising big boy on the block, which was the Roman community, in the hopes of forming a treaty of some sort that would shore up their alliances in the wake of any future war. This also gave rise to a small community in Rome. It seems like from Roman sources that the Jews were viewed as this kind of backward, idiosyncratic type of nation without really much interest, although other sources seem to indicate that they were very successful at proselytization. If you remember, in this time in Rome, it's kind of a great philosophical time. It was a time when Roman culture was viewed as kind of the great achievement of humanity and its intellect and its education, etc. In fact, the movement of the Roman Empire in later generations, which ultimately also leads to the destruction of the temple, was not so much as an attempt of Alexander the Great to expand his monarchy that he could rule over. The goal was, and this Rav Soloveitchik points out in one of his shiurim on Hanukkah, the goal was to expand Roman culture. They believed Roman culture was the highest and most intellectual and academic, and therefore they wanted to expand it to as many places as possible. What? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. This is 161 BCE, which the Greeks are still on top, at least for the moment, but the Greek armies are waning, and this is the ascendancy of Rome. Obviously, what kind of hurt Jewish-Roman relationships was the revolt in 66 CE, which ultimately leads to the destruction of the temple in 70 CE, and then later on the Bar Kokhba revolt in 132 CE. Both of these produced made the communities in Rome grow substantially. The reason the communities in Rome grew substantially is because you bring in a ton of refugees and captives, so that's going to make your Jewish community grow. But also it inspires a great deal of anti-Jewish sentiment. We're all kind of familiar with the Arch of Titus and the victorious celebration that went on in Rome in the wake of the defeat of the Jewish people. And so it didn't bode well for Jewish communities. That being said, from that moment, Rome and Italy more generally got the reputation of being a place where there were many, many scholars of the Jewish people who were exiled during the destruction of the temple. And that scholarship kind of remained one of the prides of the Roman community throughout history. Yeah. So in those days, so this is all pre-Christian Rome. This is all pre-Christian Italy. Pre-Christian Italy and even post-Christian Italy, so the entire boot of Italy is not one unified people. It's more of these small kind of kingdoms, or they call themselves kingdoms or city-states. There's everything to the north, dominated by Venice. Then there's in the center Rome, and then there's, Sicily and others in the south, which are going to come under Spanish influence, but we'll see that a little bit later. 313 CE, of course, is post-Christian Rome. Constantine makes Christianity the official religion, and also it institutionalizes the oppression of the Jewish people within Rome. So even though the community remains strong, nevertheless, this institutionalized oppression didn't help it. What ultimately, ironically enough, helped the Jews in Christian Rome and actually throughout Europe was a statement of Augustine. Augustine, a little bit later on, says that you can't hurt Jews. Why shouldn't you be allowed to Jews? Because the Jews are there to bear witness and testimony to the fact that God chose Jesus and rejected the Jews. So their poverty-stricken, downtrodden lifestyles were themselves proof of Christian ascendancy. The Christian revolution settles down in post-Constantine Rome. As you get to the years 493 to 426 to 526, you get to flourishing Jewish communities throughout the Italian boot, particularly in Naples, where it's recorded that in Naples, the Jews, when the Justinians attack from the north to the south into Naples, their historians record that the Jews were fought in the army to defend the kingdom against the Justinians, and it seems to indicate that there was a very comfortable relationship between Jews and their Roman hosts during the early part of the new millennium. Okay. That being said, Just a couple of interesting points. So Ashkenazi Jewry, at least for the early stages of the Middle Ages, and we'll get back to Rome, but for the early stages of the Middle Ages was dominated by the Colonimus family. A number of sources make the claim, and this is a traditional Ashkenazic claim, that the Colonimus family was actually brought over by Emperor Charlemagne to Ashkenaz, to the Rhine River, and to those areas because he wanted more Jews to move to that area. He couldn't convince them, right? Jews are an asset, particularly when usury is prohibited between Christians, so Jews are an asset to make your economy grow. But the Jews, he said, won't move. They told Charlemagne, the Jews won't move to Germany and France if they don't have their rabbis there, because Jews don't go anywhere without their rabbis. So he makes a deal with the Colonimus family, which is this family of scholars and poets from Italy. He makes a deal with them and says, if you come to Ashkenaz, then I will reward you greatly. And the feeling goes that somewhere in the year 800 or 900 CE, the Colonimus family moves to Ashkenaz and creates what we know as Ashkenaz tradition. So from that perspective, Ashkenazi Jewry very much viewed themselves, and the Maharshal records this in his Tshuvot, Ashkenazi Jewry very much viewed themselves as kind of the carrying the tradition of the early Roman and Italian Jewish communities. In the Middle Ages, things don't go well for the Jewish people in Italy. In the 1100s, expulsions begin. This is the ascendancy of the popes. Popes, as we know, are a mixed bag in terms of how they treat the Jewish people. And in the 1100s, they weren't treating them well. Jews were constantly being expelled from various areas. Rome was a safe place, ironically enough, particularly because a number of Jews in Rome had very high-ranking positions within the Vatican. What were the positions? Usually doctor or accountant, which is usually the position that one of the Jews would have. But those positions were often opportunities for those people to be able to defend the Jewish communities. 1198 to 1216, which is kind of a watershed moment for Europe in general, is the ascendancy of Pope Innocent III, who is anything but innocent, and he invents the yellow badge that ultimately becomes the historical European way for marking the Jew, all the way up to, obviously, Nazi Germany. But that was invented by Pope Innocent III. All Jews had to wear it within Rome, and depending on the relationships to the outside cities. Remember, Rome doesn't have this power over all the kingdoms that they would like to, because every kingdom has its own little kind of its own little state. This is the age of feudalism. Everybody has their own little fiefdom. What's fascinating, just I'll give you the interpretation of Rav Soloveitchik, is that he was once having a conversation with a Christian friend of his who declared that the Pope was not responsible, or the Christians were not responsible for Nazi Germany, for the anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany. And Rav Soloveitchik made what I thought was a profound interpretation. He said, we declare on Hanukkah that God saved us from the Greeks, right? That we defeated the Greeks. He says, the people that the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees defeated weren't Greeks. Who were they? They were Seleucids, right? So why do we say the Greeks were long gone by the time there's a Maccabean revolt in the year 160? So why are we declaring it? Why are we declaring it that it was against the Greeks? So he says, no, the Seleucids were a remnant after the Greeks left or dissolved in the 2nd or 3rd century BCE. So three kingdoms took over, the Seleucids, and I forgot the two others.
Ptolemy in Egypt and
Antony
in Greece.
Right. Oh,
of course. After Alexander died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe Greek, the royal family tended to be Greek.
Correct. So why do we declare?
They were Greeks the same way the Texans are Americans.
Yeah. Okay. That's on tape for time immemorial now. Okay, there you go. Okay, so
it's the culture war.
Yeah.
Between the Greek Hellenistic culture.
Correct. So that's what Rav Soloveitchik said. Rav Soloveitchik said it was the Greek Hellenized culture that ultimately created the desire to impose decrees upon the Jewish people. So the Greeks were not directly, but they were indirectly responsible for it. So from that perspective, it was a Jewish defeat over the Greeks. So Rav Soloveitchik said the same thing. He says, without 500 years, or I should say 1,500 years, of anti-Jewish sentiment in Europe, no Nazi Germany ever arises. So he says, you're right. The Pope at the time was not responsible for it, and the Christians at the time were not responsible for it, but Christianity, he thought, had to at some point take responsibility for the, you know, generations of anti-Semitism. So, you know, if you want to know where the yellow badge that ultimately found its way onto Jews in Nazi Germany, so it started with Innocent III. And then if you go, 35, 40 years later to Gregory IX, who was also a Pope, so in 1235, he has the first accusation of that we are aware of ritual murder. Of what we call the blood libels. To the credit of a lot of the northern communities, Venice, Florence, Genoa, Pisa, They reject discriminatory policies mostly for economic interests. The Jews really were the owners of the large banks and the major money lenders, and they were the economic fuel that kept the economies of those countries going, and therefore they were very much protected by those communities in the north. There weren't much rights of ownership. Remember, all land was owned by the feudal lord.
Money.
What? Money was protected by them, and the government would enforce it because, again, you need them to keep your economy going. If I chase all the Jews out, so then there's no one lending with interest, and it means your economy dies. Okay. So things kind of remain in that status quo until the major expulsions begin in Western Europe. The major expulsions begin in Western Europe in the late 13th century, first France, then England, and all things, of course, culminate with the Spanish Inquisition in 1492. In 1492, the Jews are expelled from Spain. They head to Portugal. They're expelled from Portugal. Where's the next place they start heading? They start heading to Italy in boats. Sicily, at one point, I wrote here, was 6% of the entire Sicily was Jewish at one point. But along with the Inquisition is a Catholic or a Christian movement, so they're moving towards Rome, towards Italy. So the Jews keep on moving north, and by the 16th century, the late 1500s, you have the Jews running north as quickly as possible. Things kind of really come to a head in 1553 when all the Talmuds in all of Italy are burned on Rosh Hashanah. Again, this was post-invention of the printing press. It still was not cheap to produce books at all. And in 1555, you have the creation of the Roman ghetto, which you can still go and see, the Roman Jewish ghetto, which you can still go and see to this day. One of kind of the watershed moments in terms of protecting the Jewish people in the 16th century was the appointment of Solomon of Udine, who was the Turkish ambassador to Venice. And he was also someone who the Jewish community attributes him with a lot of the great protective mechanisms that were there. So along with being the representative of the Ottoman Empire in Rome, or in Venice, he was also someone who really stood up for the Jewish people in those days and was very protective of the community. What's fascinating about the community is through all the persecutions, this was really the little Jewish community that could. Because for all the persecutions, they retained an extraordinarily high level of scholarship, an extraordinarily high level of wealth. They were known as the wealthiest Jews around, and an extraordinary high level of influence for a tiny community. You think about by what's coming in the 16th century. In the 16th century, you have this mixed bag kind of converging on northern Italy to create that Jewish community. You have the Spanish coming up from the south, who, you know, the former Muranos and the people who are escaping the Inquisition. You have the Western Europeans who didn't make it to Poland going there. And then you have the native Italians who are also there, all converging on 16th century, which is why the Rama Afano is such a fascinating individual. And I think you can see, here he is, he lives from 1548 to 1620, you can see kind of the eclectic nature of his influence and also the nature of the community just by his two teachers. Who are his two teachers? So number one is his teacher for Talmud and for Halacha, is Rabbi Shmuel Chanina ben Mordechai, who is a Spanish refugee from the Inquisition. And then his Rav, or his teacher for Kabbalah, for mysticism, is Rabbi Israel Saruk, who is this expert in Lurianic Kabbalah and the Kabbalah of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. So what you have here are kind of in one individual who becomes a fascinatingly influential individual, all converging on one, and kind of he becomes really a representative of the very eclectic nature of the Italian community. Just some historical highlights of his life, and we'll use some of his tshuvot to come up with them. But number one is he was fabulously wealthy. When I say fabulously wealthy, I mean he probably was one of the top 10 wealthiest Jews of his time. How do we know this? So we know of a couple of things. Number one is when Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, wanted to publish his Kesef Mishnah, which was a commentary on the Rambam. The person who bankrolled it and saw to it that it was published, and remember, publishing books in those days was a major, major investment. The person who bankrolled it was the Rama of Fano himself. And he took responsibility for all aspects of this publication. Number two is when he began to learn Kabbalah, when he began to learn Lurianic Kabbalah. So the greatest summaries of Lurianic Kabbalah were in the works of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, and he spent immense amounts of monies to fill up his library with the works of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. All the while that he is spending money and being fabulously wealthy, he also happens to be growing as one of the most well-known scholars around. He begins his...
How did he make his money?
The old-fashioned way. He inherited it. Probably he came from a family of bankers. That would just be my assumption. I doubt it. But it doesn't seem like that. He starts his career in Venice, in Fano, which is you can see also, he's called the Rama of Fano. There was no Jewish community in Fano by the time he is becoming a major player. He's moving north, first to Venice, and then ultimately to Mantua, where he becomes famous. In both places, he had a yeshiva. And he's also becomes fabulously well-known. We know it just from a number of his responsa, but just one, he says, Sha'alti mimeni yedidi ha'alufa Rav Yitzhak Bar Mordechai. So he says, my friend, Rav Yitzhak Bar Mordechai, asked me lichtov lecha et hadvarim shenemru bishivatenu yom asher amadata etzlenu. A certain person asked him to summarize what was being learned in the yeshiva. He was very interested by what was being discussed on the day he visited the yeshiva and asked him what they were discussing. He says, let me summarize it for you just in order that it should find good in your eyes. And we find a lot of those. A lot of those of people writing to him to request his Torah. They want to know what it is that he's teaching in his halachic positions, his interpretations, etc. Also, one of the major things he involved himself in, it seems that he really developed into, if not the leader, at least one of the leaders of the Italian Jewish community, in that he helped establish the Italian Nusach HaTfila, which was put together. In his response to number 25 in Chaf Hei here, he declares, he goes through basically a list of what a shliach tzibur should and shouldn't say. What should the cantor who is leading the congregation say? So he says, b'shirei ha-leviim shanu nogim lo'amram b'beit ha-kneset. So he says, and when we say the shirei ha-leviim, the shir shel yom that we say at the end, so he says, ani manati bimkomi shelo yiftach shliach tzibur b'lashon ha-mishnah d'sof tamin, ha-matchel ha-shir shel leviim omrim. So we say, right, hayom rom, Rishon b'Shabbos Shabbos Aleviim Orim b'Beis Hamikdash. Today is the first day of the week, and this is what's Leviim. So he cut that out. He didn't want that being said in his siddur, in his congregations. And rather, you should start from the beginning of the Mizmor. And he goes on to say things that for the Rosh Hashanah Tefillah should be done, including, he says, he brought over the Sephardic practice of saying slichos, though not he discusses the issues of whether you should start saying on Rosh Chodesh Elul, and he decides that Rosh Chodesh Elul should be exempt from slichos, and he starts saying slichos the day after Rosh Chodesh Elul, and he goes through again one of his important statements. So we see here that he was this kind of great leader and this important and influential individual in history. Another aspect.
Is there a Nusach Italy?
So it's a good question whether there's a Nusach Italy. It seems that the Italian Jewish community does have a quasi-Sephardic Nusach, which, like I said, there are very few Italian Jews that you'd be able to find. But there is a quasi-Sephardic Nusach that is associated with the Italian Jewish community. It's unique. It comes from him. I mean, he was the one who was establishing it. Remember, he has to, because his community is so eclectic, he has to find out what is authentically Sfarad, which is kind of interesting, because this whole time he's publicizing the Zohar and Lurianic Kabbalah. So this is fascinating also, because you see the convergence here of two communities. The Zohar, even though it's very influential upon the Ari, Rav Yitzhak Luria, the Zohar is the mysticism that's associated with Spanish Jewry, and Lurianic Kabbalah is the mysticism associated with Safa Jewry, which is descendant of Spanish Jewry, but it has its own unique aspects as well, and they converge in him. He is a major proponent of the Zohar, and also he happens to be his favorite mitzvah. You can see from the numerous tshuvot that he has on it, he has a special love for tefillin. He has a massive work just on tefillin and how you should put it on. He promoted the Sephardic practice based on the Zohar of putting on tefillin while you're sitting down. He promoted putting on tefillin without a bracha on Chol HaMoed Pesach, on Chol HaMoed Sukkis. He promoted a certain way of tying the knot based on the Zohar. And many of the traditions and practices that are associated with the Zohar, he promotes for Italian Jewry. Not only that, but he wrote homiletically statements of the Zohar as well, including collecting or creating an innovative mystical work called Eim Kol Chai, which everyone says is amazing. I couldn't understand a word of it, but I may not be just not be wired for it. But Eim Kol Chai, it's called Eim Kol Chai, is what we refer to as Chava, but he applies it to the uniqueness of Sarah Imenu as a mystical figure throughout history. Remember, everything is in the mystical world is a symbol for something else. So so he has this kind of fascinating interpretation of that. And he wrote numerous books on mysticism that deal with all different aspects of the Kabbalah of the Ari and of the Zohar, and he becomes one of the more influential mystical thinkers in all of history. Yeah.
Is it mystical to say that Esther ruled 127 provinces because Sarah lived 127?
Yeah. I mean, it might be. I don't know. So there are numerous kind of mystical, numerological, symbolical types of interpretations that kind of saturate the Rama Afanu's perspective. And like I said, it influences halacha and it influences homiletics as well. The final fascinating thing, so one of the best sources that I found for all of this was a book called Sefer Toldot Rav Menachem Azariah Mifanu, which was by a person named Yehuda Aryeh Lev ben Reb Yaakov. It was published in Prietrikov around the turn of the century, but 1903, the turn of that century, not this century. It's basically a biography. It's one of the early biographies that were ever written about the Rama Afanu. So if you read the biography that's written by Rav Yehuda Aryeh Lev ben Reb Yaakov, so you see that he definitely had an agenda. His agenda was to prove that the Zohar and Jewish mysticism is very, very important. And the Rama Afanu basically publicized it and brought it to a community and showed them the brilliance, beauty, and splendor of the Zohar. And that's why he was such an important figure. He also goes through a number of the Shelot Tshuvot, a number of the responsa of the Rama Afanu, and he's one of the first people. He's very innovative in his ability to glean historical information from the responsa of the Rama Afanu. So that's some of the interesting stuff. So you read through, and he has fascinating issues. A number of things that he says is that he had a massive influence later on. on some later mystics. To give an example, the Chida, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the great Sephardic and North African scholar, quotes the Rama Afano in a number of occasions when using his mysticism. Interestingly enough, Rav Yaakov Emdin and Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, who agreed on very little in their lifetimes, the fight that the two of them shared is famous by now. But nevertheless, they both are when dealing with mysticism are very much committed to the mysticism of the Rama of Fanu, and he's quoted there in numerous cases. And you see in a number of halachic issues, the positions that he took, particularly on liturgy, are ones which come up a lot. Again, Kabbalists in general were interested in liturgy, but him in particular. Also, some of his interpretations of Tosfos were themselves also. He was very much interested in proper text and girsa. Of Tosfos and of the Gemara, and figuring out what the simple meaning of the text is, cutting away all the other things. And also, one of the fascinating things about the book is he publishes a number of the kinos that were written after the Rama Afano died. So you say, well, what does it mean that you write kinos? So if they're writing kinos, if they're writing elegies to be read in synagogue after you die, so very few people in history. In history have gotten that type of treatment, to have elegies written for them after they die. The Rambam gets it. Various kings of Israel have gotten it. But, the Rama Afano, it seems that he was, for the Italian Jewish community, a seminal figure in the same way that we might look to, let's say, the Vilna Gaon in the Ashkenazi community, or the Baal Shem Tov in the Hasidic community, or the Rambam in the Yemenite community, or the Rav Yosef Karo in the Sephardic community. The way we might view one of those seminal figures, the Rama Afano is a seminal figure in terms of the creation and the formation of Italian Jewry, and therefore he's someone who has much more power and influence than we realize. And again, we spoke already about how the Italian Jewish community was viewed both by Sephardim and Ashkenazim. They view that community with a great deal of reverence. Remember, the Ashkenazim, one of their great prides was the fact that their scholars were trained by the Kolonimus family that was born and raised in Italy, and kind of has this descendancy from the original Beit Sheni, the Second Temple period people. One of the fascinating issues that is the most controversial issues about the Italian Jewish community is that they were clean shaven. This, and you think, well, big deal. There are lots. How many Jews are clean shaven? Well, in the 17th century and the 16th century, Jews weren't clean shaven. It just didn't happen. There were very little ways to remove the hair from your face. One of them being an extraordinarily painful, type of powder that you would use to remove it from your face. And nevertheless, across the board, the Italian Jews were clean shaven. And so, if you go back to Rav Yehuda Aryeh Leib Ben Yaakov's biography, which is not a long book, but nevertheless, so you go through the chapters. So I'll read you for you what his chapters are. So Perek Aleph, he says, Hashkafa Ktzara Amatzav Limudim Midinat Atalia, basically a background to what Torah learning was like in Italy, the breadth and depth of the learning. They tended to be more worldly than they were in other countries. Perek Bet is Toldot Yemei Chaye HaRama, is the biography of the Rama, is the chapter 2. Perek Gimel is Tchunot Nefesh HaRama, basically what his midos were, what type of qualities did he have. Perek Dalet is an overview of Sifrei HaRama, an overview of his publications. Number 5 is Malat Kedushat HaRama, basically his mystical studies. And number 6, he says, Barur divarim bidivrei harav be'er eshek hasharato heyot harama mugulez zakan kiminhag italia. So basically, out of a book that has only six chapters, 1/6 of the book, the entire sixth chapter, is on dealing with the claim made by the responsa called the Be'er Eshek that the Rama did not have a beard like those who live in Italy. Okay, this was it. So what does the Shelo Tuchuvo Be'er Eshek say? So he was asked about whether a Jew needs to have a beard or not. Is it, you know, because it was still, in those days, it was still a debated issue whether Jews could even walk around without beards. So he says, "Va'ananav shai darashti v'chakarti heitev." The Be'er Eshek says, "I searched and I looked through it. Ha'ich inhig haramami panu zecher tzaduk v'kadosh levracha." I went back and I looked. I did all the research to see what was the practice of the Rama Fano. V'yadati anachon ki kol erev Shabbat hava hayif roshe dekireach hava bereshe. I happen to know grass doesn't grow on a busy street. So the Rama was, he says, kireach bereshe. He was bald as an eagle. Right, and what would he do in order to look nice for Shabbos? Mistaper b'dekane k'minag Italia, he would shave off his beard as well as the practice of in Italy. This created a controversy in response that goes on for if I told you. So this the Be'er Eshek is a 18th century work. It's till the 19th century, till the 20th, almost the 20th century. The question of the Rama of Fano's beard and how he shaved it was those. One guy says, "Oh, it's impossible that he used a scissor." They say they used some sort of two-sided scissor. Couldn't have been. He used the powder. He used the cream. He used this. Oh my goodness, you can't even believe it. But this is one of the things because it was known that the Italian Jewish community, the practice was not to have beards in the Italian Jewish community, which was scandalous in both the Sephardic and Ashkenazi communities of the time. Just a little bit fascinating kind of addendum or a coda to the story. During his lifetime, you never would have known that this was controversial. Only years later does his beardlessness, or perhaps beardlessness, one person claims that no, he had a beard, he just trimmed his beard so that it should be very short. But a number of these issues come up. It's just another kind of, like I said, a fascinating coda to the Rama Afano. This is the Rama Afano is not the end of the Italian Jewish community. The Italian Jewish community goes strong. We'll learn later on about Ramchav and Moshe Chaim Luzzatto and the Mesilat Yesharim and him also being a mystic. But what he does do is change the trajectory. Whereas it was kind of a quiet community in terms of what it was dabbling in. Once the Rama Afanu comes along, is you create this kind of great halachic kind of tradition, and it also inspires a great deal of Kabbalistic learning, which I said we're going to find out more about when we see the Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. So that is kind of the end of that kind of issue. Like I said, the Italian Jewish community is very much on the periphery in terms of the massive movements in Europe, so we don't think about it that much. Like I said, they really became a refuge for both Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews. They had their own kind of rich tradition, and the Rama Afanu is kind of the one who developed out of that rich tradition. And again, one of their rich traditions was apparently being beardless in the Middle Ages, which, like I said, was scandalous. And you'll see later in the 19th century already a number of communities, the German Jewish community, even parts of the Lithuanian community are also in Slobodka. God forbid, unless the Rosh Yeshiva would show up with a beard. Everyone else better be clean shaven every day because they should look like the princes of Europe. But again, we can get to those issues when the time comes. Questions, comments?
Italian Jews today aware of him?
I think so. The truth is, in halachic literature, the Rama Afano is not unknown. Like I said, he's not quoted as often as you'll hear other people quoted, but his value as an interpreter is not unknown at all.
Categorize him as Sephardic, or is Italian?
He's Italian. Yeah. And don't mess with him, or you'll end up sleeping with the fishes. You know.
Now
I'm
going to Sicilian.
Okay.
At what time Zafar and Kabbalah
The Zohar and the Kabbalah become popularized and in the around the middle of the 13th century. So Kabbalah is popular before then. The Zohar as a full text. $1 million question. It was written by Rosh Shimon Bar Yochai in the Mishnaic period.
And when they started crowning it?
What?
When they started
what? It was Rav Moshe de Leon is the one who reveals it in the mid 13th century. Yeah. Well, oh, no, no, no. So the Zohar was controversial from the first second it was produced. Yeah, yeah, from the first second it was produced, it was controversial, and different communities chose different paths in terms of how to approach it. For the most part, at least at this point in history, meaning in the 16th century, Ashkenazi Jewry is not viewing the Zohar as a halachic source. Only because traditionally its scholars were not studying the Zohar. Whereas the Sephardic community, and then after the Rama Afano, certainly the Italian community, is viewing it as a halachic source.
And they're
studying it. I mean, I don't know who's studying it. It's impossible to say. But Ashkenazim have, you know, the famous prohibition of not studying Zohar. Zohar becomes influential in Ashkenazi Jewry after the Vilna Gaon, right, and the Baal Shem Tov, both of whom were studying Kabbalah. Right, people don't realize the Vilna Gaon wrote only one full work in his entire life, and that was a commentary on the Zohar. So the Vilna Gaon is very much entrenched in that type of interpretation. There was. We'll see. Not every mystic is a Kabbalist, and every Kabbalist is a mystic. But patience. We're not even yet out of the 16th century, so we got
yeah.